We closed last time with the 10th chapter and the fourth verse of the book of Isaiah. Now let me go back and you'll notice one or two things that lead up to this lesson tonight. We begin with verse 5 with God's prophecy against the Assyrians. The fact that he was going to use the Assyrians, then what he would do with them, that he would destroy them. Now as you look back to the 7th chapter, when God sent Isaiah to appear unto Ahaz, he took with him his son Shear-Jashub. And that word means a remnant shall return. Now that comes up in our lesson tonight. Then in verse 17, God said unto Ahaz, Jehovah will bring upon thee and upon thy people and upon thy father's house days that have not come from the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, even the king of Assyria. All right, now there's the promise that Assyria was going to come. Now, Tiglath-Pileser began his invasion of northern Israel in about 727, I think it was, along there. He died. Then one of his generals, Sargon, took the city, destroyed it, that is of Samaria. And then in 702, the Assyrians came back under Sennacherib and tried to take Jerusalem. We've got a period there of less than 30 years. Some might say 25 or 30, but let's say 30 for a round number. A period of about 30 years we are dealing with in the book of Isaiah here, up to this point, with the Assyrians. Well, that means when God said we're going to do it shortly, why, 30 years is a very short time when it comes to the history of a nation that contended for 1,400 or 1,500 years. And so that is a short time. All right, now coming to our lesson tonight, in the last part of chapter 9, here you have four times that God says, let's start with verse 12 here, when he says, for all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. Drop down here to the end of verse 17, you have the same thought. For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. Now the same thought in verse 21. For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. And now then the same thought, down in the close of verse 4 in the 10th chapter. Now there are four times that God says that his anger is not turned away. His hand is stretched out still. That is, the hand of judgment against his own nation, against the Jews. All right, now, in this passage here, this is a very important passage, chapter 10, verse 5, through the end of the chapter. Very important because it points out two things. That God was going to bring the Assyrians against them, fulfilling his word. And the other is that God raises up nations, uses them to accomplish his purpose, then destroys them. So this ought to be a passage marked in your Bible somewhere that you can remember when you want to discuss that. Ho Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation. I will send him against a profane nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread down them down like the mire of the streets. Now notice how many personal pronouns you have. Thine, I again. In other words, God is acting. It's an expression of God's indignation against wickedness. It's God who's going to raise up the Assyrians. It's God who's going to use them, going to bring them and use them. Now notice this point. Howbeit he, that is the Assyrian, meaneth not so. Neither doth his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. Now God says, I'm going to use him. But he doesn't mean to be used by me. Now how could God use the man? He said it's in his heart to cut off nations, not a few. That is to destroy the world. So since that was the Assyrian's disposition, God would use him in that condition without violating the man's own will in the matter. And that's the thing that's impressed me in studying the Bible, the Old Testament especially, is how that, and the New Testament as well, it's also in the New as well, how that God can use a nation or use an individual, and yet that individual always acts according to his own will. Now you take, so many of them. Now here's this one as a nation, and then the man that betrayed and denied, betrayed the Lord there. What's in the world? When I start thinking, the name was O'Blank. You know what I'm talking about. So here you have God using an individual or a nation, yet always consistent with that individual's will, never violating his will. I think he uses us today as we submit or don't submit. Right? Now notice then further here, for he, it's in his heart to do this. For he saith, are not my princes, all of them kings? Is not, now I'm hearing names, a number of cities that either he had taken or was taking. It may be that Isaiah is speaking in the past tense of something that was going to happen, it already happened. And on the other hand, he probably had already taken these and had come here to Nob. But now notice, now he boasts here when he says here, for are not my princes, all of them kings? All right, now Calno was to the north as well as Carchemish, the northern part of, it's really north of Israel, way up there, north of the Judah country, in Syria, in a part of Syria. Now you take them, those two cities, Calno and Carchemish. Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? Now there are six cities that he has already taken. Each one of them, no different bill. He took one, he took the other. Took each one of them. As my hand, now notice his boast, as my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven image did excel them at Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? Now the point was this. This Assyrian, he considered his success in taking cities to be an expression of the weakness of their gods, of their idols. But now then, Samaria didn't have as many idols as these others, and although Jerusalem had turned to idolatry, yet her idols were not as many as the others, but actually the idols were not their gods anyway. It was Jehovah. The point that this king failed to recognize was that he was dealing with God and God's kingdom and God's nation in this matter. I think the same thing is true to David. I'll come to that in just a few moments. Now notice he moves on here. Wherefore, it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem. Now notice, I raised the whole Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in his hand, mine indignation. I was sending against a profane nation. Now God was using the Assyrians, sending them against the profane nation of Judah and Jerusalem, the city. Now then, God says, when I completed my work upon these cities, when the Lord has performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, that is, by the Assyrians, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. So he'd been boasting of what he did and all that, how he took them. Now God says, when I have used him, back here in this verse, and I didn't say enough of that verse, 6 and 7 here, well, under verse 5 it is, holy city, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation. And here's a rod or a staff that he's going to use as the instrument of punishment against Judah and Jerusalem. Right? So, now, when God has used him there, when he performed his whole work upon them, then he's going to punish the heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. So what I want us to notice is that this, the rod or the staff of God's indignation, of his punishment, of his instrument of judgment against the Jews, against Israel, and, I mean Judah and Israel, 7:22, against Judah and Jerusalem, would be the Assyrians. There would be a rod in his hand. Now when we read of Jesus, the rod of his that he uses, Psalm, the second Psalm there, he had destroyed them with a rod of iron, the nations. And over in Revelation, the 19th chapter, verses about 15 to 16 to 17, where here again is the rod of his indignation. He's using one nation to destroy another. That's what God did here. That's what God's always done and still doing. And I think it helps us to read the papers and to listen to the news and to see a build-up in this country and in Russia and others here. Now someday going to be the rod of God's anger and indignation against this nation. He's going to use it against it because no nation can become as wicked as this one is and not after a while suffer the consequence of it. Can't do it. Alright? So God said, I'll punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. The fruit, that would be his offspring there. For he has said, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding, and I have removed the bounds of the peoples, and have robbed their treasures, and like a valiant man, I have brought down them that sit on thrones, and my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the peoples, and as one gathereth eggs that are forsaken, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved a wing or that opened the mouth or that chirped. All right, now that's the boast of the Assyrians. He's already boasted here of what the cities he had taken. Now he's boasting of what he's doing. He said, why, all of these nations, he was sweeping across the world there and taking all of those nations. Just like Hitler was in World War II. He was sweeping across and taking everything. People say, why doesn't God stop him? I learned in the book of Habakkuk that God was using him. I'm not the Habakkuk talking about him, setting forth the principle, but God was using him as an instrument of his judgment against nations that had become so wicked they needed it. Then he used the United States and Britain to destroy Germany. Now then, when we become so wicked that we're no longer fit to live or need a good thrashing, then he'll raise up a nation against us. This is the teaching of the Bible all the way through. I pointed that out a number of times, of course. You remember my teaching on that. But now here's God's answer to that. So his boast is then that as you find a nest where the birds have flown off from it, I just scooped up the eggs in my basket and kept it going. And nothing chirped. There wasn't none of it. It's like a little baby bird trying to resist an eagle or something that comes there that take it away. So they couldn't do a thing. It was just like baby birds in his hand. That's his boast. All right, now here's God's answer. Now look at God's answer. This is important. Beginning with verse 50. Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Shall the saw magnify itself against him that wieldeth it? Now here's a man with an axe, swing the axe. Shall the axe boast itself against the man that use it? Here's a carpenter using a saw. Either the saw using the man or the man using the saw. Shall the saw boast itself against the man? Not again. Now here's another. As if a rod should wield them that lift it up, or as if a staff should lift up him that is not wood. So here's a man with a rod thrashing out something, thrashing the grain or whatever it is. Here he is with a staff directing and guiding. Well, the staff or the rod does not boast itself against him to use it. Here's the individual uses the axe, he uses the saw, he uses the rod, he uses the staff. Right, now, the application is what? Therefore will the Lord Jehovah of hosts send among his fat ones leanness, that is among the Assyrians, and under his glory there shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. Now, was this king doing this of his own will? Well, no. He was an axe, he was a saw, he was a staff, he was a rod in the hand of Jehovah. God was using him. And that's the point that's taught throughout the Bible, is God using the nation. One of the sad things to me, when I listen to these people talk about all of these babies of unborn, unwed mothers and all that sort of thing, and you know, one thing they never mention, the moral aspect of it. And I never heard one mention that. Now, I might have got on one of those religious people. They might. I'm talking about the news media. And these, have you ever heard one of them mention them? I never heard them mention the moral aspect of it. And on these talk shows, well, several of them, they get that involved in that talk show. But morality is never raised as an issue. And morality is the issue. That's the basis of it. But that's never mentioned. Now, then they're going to a court trial out in California there over the rights of an unborn fetus. I think it's ridiculous or silly, but everything they do out there, I mean, in those courts are silly anyway. It doesn't make a lot of difference. But now let's come on back to God. Now, verse 17. And the light of Israel will be for a fire. Now, God's going to put a fire under his glory. For a fire, and his Holy One, that's God, for a flame. And it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day. That just means in a short time. So God's going to be the fire that set under him and bring him to naught. God does it. God does it. And he will consume the glory of his forest and of his fruitful field, both soul and body, and it shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. That is, God's going to destroy all the trees there, the great ones among them, and the standard bearer. Here's a standard bearer, and the standard bearers here and yonder, the standard they raise. Of course, in those days, there was no television, walkie-talkies, and all that. They had to raise the standard, and that would show the rallying point, where to meet for attack. But when the standard bearer falls, then they're in confusion, aren't they? That throws the army in confusion. So it will be as when the standard bearer falls, and the nation is thrown into confusion, because with their great ones gone and destroyed, then what? To whom shall they look? So this is the idea. God does all that. Well, let's look a little further. when his bride's in one day. And he will consume the glory of his forest. And I read that. And the standard bearer fainted, rather. Faints and falls. And the remnant of the trees of his forest shall be few, so that a child may write them. That is, number them. Count them. Write down the number. So here, when the great Assyrian forest. Now, here you see a big forest. You've ever been up. Well, I guess I haven't up on the mountains here. I haven't been up where there was one. But out in Oregon and Washington, when I've been up there different times, here would be a whole mountainside here, whole acres after acres, burned off with just a few stumps here in your understanding, and you could count them. Well, that's the idea here. Now, when God gets through the Assyrians, there will be so few of their great ones left that a child can go through and number them. He can count them. That's God's claim there. All right. Now, and it shall come to pass in that day, now that's the day when God shall have destroyed them, that the remnant of Israel and they that are escaped of the house of Jacob shall no more lean upon him that smote them, but shall lean upon Jehovah, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. Not in the lies and falsehoods of idolatry, not in the lies and falsehood of these covenants and agreements made with these heathen nations. The remnant will lean upon Jehovah. Now, that's an important point to remember that. That there will be a remnant. Now, even out of the northern tribes of Israel, as well as Judah, there would be a remnant that would return. But it would be a remnant that returned leaning upon Jehovah. Now look with me back in the first chapter in verse 9. Here we had that. Mention that when we went over at the first, but it ought to be marked 1 and 9, where God said, except Jehovah of hosts had left unto us a very small remnant, we should have been as Sodom. We should have been like unto Gomorrah. That is, if God hadn't left us a very small remnant. Now notice that other expression there, a remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. Now look back at 7:3, when Isaiah and his son Shear-Jashub appeared unto Ahaz. Now look at 7:3. Then said Jehovah unto Isaiah, go forth now to meet Ahaz, thou and Shear-Jashub. Now that word Shear-Jashub means a remnant shall return. All right. thy son at the end of the conduit of the upper pool, and there I say, say unto Ahaz, take heed and be quiet, fear not, neither let thy heart faint, and all that. But here he took Shear-Jashub to indicate that a remnant would return. And so now then, he declares here that a remnant shall return. But when they come back, when this remnant that's escaped comes back, they'll lean upon Jehovah, the Holy One of Israel. Now that's an expression that is found over and over in the book of Isaiah. The Holy One of Israel. A remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. Now remember back here in the 7th chapter, and verse 6, where unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now we studied that one 2 weeks ago, when we met here last time. We studied that passage. Right, now here, the one who was to be born would be called Mighty God. Now here shall the remnant of Jacob unto the mighty God. Right, that identifies Christ with God. The son to be born, the child to be born, the son given, would be mighty God, related both to God and man. Well, all right. Unto the mighty God, for though thy people, thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant of them shall return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. That is, it will be a righteous judgment that overflows and destroys the enemy. Now I want you to note that, though Israel be as the sand of the sea, only a remnant shall return. Now, what's the difference between that statement and the claims of premillennialists? What are they looking for? They're looking for all Israel to be converted and go back there. Now, and so they said because that the people as a nation rejected Jehovah, therefore Jehovah built the church instead of establishing the kingdom. Because, and now let's say further, that since all of Israel did not come back, then God will have to bring them back in order to fulfill some of the promises of the Old Testament. Did God ever promise they'd bring all the Jews back? Never. Remember that. It's always a remnant. So when you're talking to premillennialists, and they're talking about, well, all those Jews are going to have to be converted to come back for the promises of God to be fulfilled. What promise? Why did God ever promise it? Oh, he'd bring them all back. He said, I won't bring them all back, though they be as the sand of the sea. It's the remnant that's going to be saved. That's all that was going to be saved under the first restoration. That's all that was saved under the second, under Christ, under the redemption under him. We're all right. So, and this judgment here, this destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. That is the destruction of the Assyrians, but not only them, but the destruction of the Jews. That would be a judgment overflowing with righteousness. It was a righteous judgment. I know it sounds awfully terrible to think there are those hundreds of thousands of Jews that were slain by the Romans. I know that's terrible. It was terrible when they were destroyed by the Assyrians. It was terrible when they were destroyed by the Babylonians and the Romans. But on the other hand, what kind of attitude had they had toward God? What kind of a standard were they living by? A standard of wickedness, rebellion, idolatry. Now then, a judgment against this nation today, would it be a righteous judgment or an unrighteous judgment? What's the attitude toward the American people toward God? Just a good cuss word, that's about all, isn't it? It's about the only way they can use God, is just cuss word. Listen to these television programs. God's name comes in over and over in a profane way among them, to where you just want to turn the thing off and get out of there. But and we could do that, but you know the next is going to do the same thing. Alright? So there was the righteous for a full end. And that determined will the Lord Jehovah of hosts make in the midst of all the earth. Not only the Assyrians. Later on, not only the Babylonians. Later on, not only the Medo-Persians, but also the Jews. So as a kingdom or a nation, they were destroyed. They'll never exist again as such. As a people, and I've said this before, as a people, they'll never be destroyed. They'll always exist as a monument to the fact that God has spoken. Now this passage again, I've mentioned a number of times. Jeremiah 30 and verse 11. For I am with thee, saith Jehovah, it's 100 years after Isaiah, to save thee, for I will make a full end of all the nations, whither I scattered thee, but I will not make a full end of thee, but I will correct thee in measure, and will in no wise leave thee unpunished. I'll never destroy all the Jews. They exist as a clannish people, separate apart from the rest of our people today, a monument to the fact that God has spoken. They'll never again exist as a nation. That is the nation that God destroyed. Oh, yeah, a bunch of them are going back to Jerusalem, set up a political economic kingdom over there, but it's not what God destroyed. What God destroyed will never be restored, because there must be a king of the house of David. There must be a priesthood of the house of Levi. And not a Jew on earth can tell you of what tribe he is today. Not a one. So, millennialism is one of it's as silly as any other thing that's ever come up this long. All of them are silly. All right, now that's what he's going to do. I'm going to use the Assyrians. Then I'm going to clean them out. I'll take care of them. Now look further. Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah of hosts, O my people that dwellest in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian, though he smite thee with a rod and lift up his staff against thee after the manner of Egypt. That is, if Egypt mistreated you down there, and these lift up their rod against you, don't be afraid of them. Why? Because God is in control. They've never taken it if the people had done right. If they had lived according to God's standard, the conditions that God laid down back in Deuteronomy 28, Leviticus 28, that's right. Leviticus 26. Those two, God laid down the terms on which you're going to be my people and I will be your God. And if you don't live to that, then here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to carry you away by a people whose language you won't understand into a land whose gods you do not know. And he did that. He did it. He told us today, what are you going to do to us today if we don't live according to the standard today? No, we don't believe it. People don't believe it. All right? Be not afraid of them. For yet a very little while, about 30 years from the time of Tiglath-Pileser down to the time of Sennacherib, 702 and 1 there, when God finally destroyed the 185,000 Assyrians in one night, you have about almost a 30-year period, which is a very little while. And this was spoken after that. This was spoken probably around 716, something like that, or 17, probably 7, 7:17. For yet a very little while, and the indignation against thee shall be accomplished, that is against Judah and Jerusalem, the Jews, accomplished, and mine anger shall be directed to his destruction. Whose destruction? The Assyrians' destruction. Be directed to him, and Jehovah of hosts will stir up against him a scourge as in the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. That's back in Judges the 7th chapter, when God took Gideon and his 300 and put those through the Midianites into such consternation that they began to kill one another that night and pulled out of there and left. Well, God said, I'll do the same thing with these. I'll do it with the Assyrians. And it and his rod will be over the sea, and God's rod will be over the sea, and he will lift it up after the manner of Egypt. In other words, I lifted up the rod over Egypt, and the Egyptian trying to go through were killed, were drowned, so I'll destroy these Assyrians. Well, is God able to do that? That's a matter of faith. I believe that God still does that, still acts that, we can still do it, and he may not lift up a rod and have them drowned in the sea, but when God determines the death of a nation, then he raises up the instrument by which it's accomplished. Always has, will tonight, always will, as long as he's God. And it shall come to pass in that day that his burden shall depart from off thy shoulder, and a yoke from off thy neck, and the yoke shall be destroyed by reason of fatness. I don't know what that last expression means. And nobody does, for sure. Some commentators have suggested that it means here is an oxen and a yoke, and he grows stronger, he bursts the yoke. All right, you do the same. You, under Jehovah, you become stronger and you burst the yoke. If that is what it means, I don't know. That's as good a guess as any, and it's a pure guess on the part of anybody. All right. Now here he pictures him as coming. He's on his way now. I don't know whether he left Assyria or whether he was on his way. Actually, he's on his way right now, because we don't get to him. We don't see a destruction until the we come to the 36th chapter of the book. Let me turn to that in a moment. Now notice, he has come to Ai. That's probably the city of Ai that we're accomplished with. He has passed through Migron. At Michmash, he layeth up his baggage. These are cities now, starting on the farthest one, coming on down toward Jerusalem. They've gone over the pass. They have taken up their lodging at Geba. Ramah trembleth. Gibeah of Saul is fled. The people have left the city. Cry aloud with thy voice, O daughter of Galim. Hearken, O Lashah. O thou poor Anathoth. Anathoth was the home of Jeremiah later on. That's only about 3 miles from Jerusalem, Anathoth was. Madmena is a fugitive. The inhabitants of Gibeon flee for safety. This very day, she halted Nob. Now Nob was closer. That's about 2 miles from Jerusalem. Why, when you reach that, you can see the sea in the distance. He shaked his hand at the mount of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Now, I'm of the opinion that it's before the Assyria did that. Or it may be that it was that time that he wrote this. That I don't know. Don't argue that, because lots of times Isaiah uses what is called the prophetic perfect. That means he speaks of a thing in the future as already past, as already at hand, at hand or past. And that's done over and over. I'll be calling attention to that as we go along. So now whether he sees them in vision as on his way, passing on and coming on and shaking his hand, saying, it's almost in my power now, Jerusalem is. Yet he didn't know he was fighting against God. So he goes on to say here, in this, that the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem, shakes his hand at it. Behold, the Lord Jehovah of hosts will lop the boughs with terror, and the high of stature shall be hewn down, and the lofty shall be brought low. And he will cut down the thickets of the forest with iron, and Lebanon shall fall by a mighty one. Now that's a figure of speech. Here those mighty cedars of Lebanon, to the north there, up on the Mount Hermon, or the other mountain there. Here's the Assyrians on their way. So if one would cut down those forests there with a mighty blow, so God will cut down the mighty ones of Assyria. He'll be the one that'll take them down. Now before I leave that, I want to turn to the 36th chapter, where here is where it finally took place. We'll not come to that for some time yet, but when Sennacherib surrounded the city, I'll get to the 37th chapter. Yeah, 37th chapter, verse 36, that's where I'm on, 37, 36. Now here, Sennacherib was at Lachish, fighting at Lachish, and he sent 185,000 of his men against Jerusalem. Now, how near they arrived, I don't know. And the angel of Jehovah went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies. Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt at Nineveh. It came to pass as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, at Adrammelech and Sharezer, his son, smote him with a sword, and they escaped into the land of Ararat, and Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. But that was 20 years later. Yeah, this is 701, and it was 681 when those two boys killed their father. So you see, the time element, there's really no element with God. And so here when he said a short time, 30 years is a short time. And as I look back 30 years ago, and the change has taken place in this country in 30 years, such a short time. Nobody would imagine it could have undergone such a change. Right, but anyway, there's where God finally destroyed the Assyrians. 185,000. Now, the king himself, Sennacherib, was at Lachish. And this was an army. So now, how near they got to Jerusalem, whether they camped about the city or were just inside of it or what, I don't know. Well, we just know that that's what happened. Well, all right. Now then, with that before us, and God's going to use the Assyrians and destroy the Assyrians. Now, don't be afraid, because I haven't forgotten my promise to David. Back in 2 Samuel, where God sent Nathan unto David to tell him what he was going to do in this 7th chapter, 2 Samuel 7. Now, here was God's promise unto him. In 2 Samuel 7, verses 13, about 11. Moreover, Jehovah telleth, 2 Samuel 7, verse 11 through 13 and 14. Moreover, Jehovah telleth thee that Jehovah will make thee a house. Make thee a house. That's a house of state, not a dwelling place. When thy days are fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, that shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commit iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men, and with the stripes of the children of men. But my loving kindness shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I put away before thee. And thy house and thy kingdom shall be made sure forever before thee. Thy throne shall be established forever. According to all these words, according to this vision, so did Nathan speak unto David. Now, God hasn't forgotten that. Now, you see, he raised that, pointed out that thought in the 7th chapter. In verse 14, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son, Saul, a name called Emmanuel. That is God with us. It's going to be the seed of David and the seed of God, the Son of God. Now, here in the 9th chapter, verses 6 through 7, there again, he introduces that again. All right, now, in the 11th chapter, this is wholly messianic. Now, this is another strongly messianic passage. I'm going to read as much of this as I can. I'd hope to get to both of them, but I didn't. And there shall come forth a shoot out of the stock of Jesse. Now, the house of David will be in such a state of decay that instead of mentioning the house of David, he mentioned the house of Jesse. But Jesse, you remember, was the father of David. So it was his house. Now, over in Amos, the 9th chapter, you have this interesting statement, verse 11. In that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen, close up the breaches thereof, and I will raise up its ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old, that they may possess the remnant of Edom, and all the nations that are called by name, saith Jehovah that doeth this. Now that's quoted by James in Acts the 15th chapter, and applied to Jesus Christ. So I know that's messianic. The house was fallen into decay. God would raise up his seed. All right, now that's what he's talking about in Amos. That's what he's talking about in Isaiah. It's just passage after passage pointing to the Messiah through whom he would do this, which he promised to do, which he intended to do. Now let me move on. A shoot out of the stock of Jesse, and a branch out of its roots shall bear fruit, and the Spirit of Jehovah shall rest upon him. So on. Now boy, look at that. Now here then, the house of David, who was the house of Jesse, would be just a stump. It would be almost a dead stump, but there would still be some life down in the roots there, from which roots through this stump this Messiah would come. And that's what he's talking about here when he says here in this, that out of the roots of that shall come forth a shoot out of the stock of Jesse. Here's a shoot that's going to come forth out of that. All right, now notice further here. And the Spirit of Jehovah shall rest upon him. Well, you remember this baptism, the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, descended upon him. And rest upon him. Now, that Spirit, you have three couplets here. describing the character of that spirit. Not seven spirits, one spirit with these six characteristics. Three twos. Now notice that. The spirit of Jehovah shall rest upon. The spirit of wisdom and understanding. Now wisdom is insight into the underlying causes and consequences of a thing, and the understanding is the ability to use that in a profitable way. All right, so it's the spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might. Right ahead, his name shall be called a wonderful counselor. All right, the one who's able to give proper counsel and with the might and the power to help you to carry out that which he counsels you to do. Then third, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of Jehovah. And there'll be the knowledge of God, and there'll be reverence for God to live according to that knowledge that God gives him of himself. That's the Christ. For Christ had an inherent knowledge of God as well as a knowledge that he learned. And his delight shall be in the fear of Jehovah, and he shall not judge after the sight of his eyes, neither decide after the hearing of his ears. He will not be determined by an external observation, but by what? By the heart. He looks upon the heart. And so he's going to look upon the heart. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. Now, he has two groups. Here are the meek, the right, judge the poor and decide, that is, those who respect him. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. Now, that's a messianic prophecy of the Christ. Now, in this spirit, here is what he is going to do. He is going to judge the poor and decide with equity for the meek of the earth. Those who seek him submit to his will. But on the other hand, the wicked here, and he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. That is, his own divine judgment. So by the rod of his mouth, the judgment, he uses the rods of men to destroy the wicked. So he rules over two realms. He rules over the realms of the nations, and he rules over the righteous. He exercises in Hebrews 1, verse 8 and 9, here is the scepter of uprightness, is the scepter of his kingdom. That's in his own kingdom, don't you see? The scepter of uprightness. But out here in the world, in the kingdoms of men, he is the scepter or the rod of iron, as he breaks them as a potter's vessel. So Jesus Christ rules in both of these realms. And righteousness shall be the girdle of his waist, and faithfulness the girdle of his loins. That'll be righteousness toward God and faithfulness, dedication to the cause of God for which he came. Now that is going to operate. You stand amazed. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John didn't do a better job describing the Christ that was to come than those prophets of old did. And that to me, when you look at that and just this thought, and I know my time's going to be up before I get through with it. But here, I've used this illustration before. Here is a target out yonder. All right, now back here, here was Booth, 1400 here. All right, he foretold certain things out. Come on down to 1,000. Here's David, and what he said. Here in 700. Here's Isaiah. Here's 600. Here is Jeremiah and others. Coming on down here to down here to 500. Here is Zechariah. And down here around 400, here's Malachi. Now over here is your target. All right, and here's your target set up over here. All right. Now here are these different fellows. Now we take these men here and we're blindfolded. We turn around and around at midnight. Put a bow and an arrow in their hand. And back here, this fellow shoots. And over here, here's Nathan. Here he shoots an arrow. And here is Isaiah. He's shooting some arrows. Here is Jeremiah. And here is Zechariah. And over here is Malachi. Now, come to the New Testament and turn on the light of the New Testament, and every one of them hit the bullseye. Remarkable, isn't it? Every one of them hit the bullseye in Christ. Couldn't have been apart from inspiration, divine guidance, and God directing them in what they said. Every one of them hit the bullseye in Jesus Christ. So you think about that.